Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Before I get to my spectacular guest this week, I want to once again draw attention to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. And again, I continue to promote the NFL film doc of my epic journey up Mount Everest, searching for the summit. It can be found now on NFL 360. It was on YouTube, but the NFL switched it. So that's where it's at this point. I also continue to raise money for my daughter, Amelia's Everest, through Higher Ground. It continues to be really amazing to see what we're doing to help others, and especially help my daughter, Amelia, overcome what she has, epilepsy, by empowerment. I continue to public speak out there. So if anybody needs somebody to come and jack up your audience, let me know. I'm always available. And finally, I've got over 230 podcasts just like this. I'd always appreciate the rating and review. The love elevates the popularity of the show. It's not about me. It's about inspiring others, like I continue to be on my own. So on that note, let's jump into the pod. Today, I've got a very special guest. His name is Apollo Ono. Apollo, how are you doing?
Doing great, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, I was going through, and you've got a spectacular resume, and you've got a huge diversity in terms of a lot of things that you've done. And like one of the things I was coming to you, well, I mean, there's a lot of unique things about you, but your name. And I was going through a lot of different podcasts, past recordings that you've had. I've never heard anybody ask you, like, where did you get this name? It's a cool name. It's a unique name. And I think it's a name that really stands out. It's not like, Michael Smith or something. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But having a name like Apollo Ono and all your success really, I think, helped capture a lot of people's minds in terms of who you are.
Well, my dad gave me the name, my dad being a Japanese immigrant who came to this country without speaking a word of English and had me at a time where he probably didn't know really how to raise a kid, as I'm sure a lot of parents kind of get thrown into that situation. And when he was choosing my name, he said that he wanted to choose something that was very unique and different. And so he opened up this name book, and he's like peeling through what he thought would be something special. And he used this kind of Greek in its historical context, the two AP and LO, and he used O to connect them. And that is my first name, Apollo. And so most people misspell my name because they always use two L's, because that's what autocorrect does. They think of the Greek god or the Apollo, spaceship, moon-based missions that were associated with the name, but mine's just with one L. And it means to lead away from. That's the meaning of away from a large pack. So it was quite fitting. I don't know if my dad ever thought that I was going to be a short track speed skater. I don't think anyone did, but it was really fitting, man. So, my dad was a visionary, I would say, in a number of different ways. Yeah. And even to this day has always like had extremely high aspirations for me and things that he wanted me to live up to. So,
and I should have asked you this before we went on, because I think this is a lot of part of your story. Your dad seems like just a remarkable person, and you've, certainly have taken the baton and taken it in a lot of different directions you're doing today. But you did grow up with a single parent, your dad raising you. And what was the circumstance that led to him having custody or taking control and really shaping your future? I mean, he did a remarkable thing. I assume he was working, it sounds like he's very driven as well. And, through that period of time, I'm a parent of two daughters, and I can't imagine, while I was working full time, also trying to raise two daughters and make that work. And I'm sure you were out there with a ton of energy. Sounds like you did. Like, what was the circumstance around where he found himself as a single parent to raise you?
Well, I think in my dad's situation, I don't know if it was something that he found himself into. I think it was something that he said that he wanted to take kind of the bull by its horns. So mm-hmm. he thought that he was in the best possible position to raise me. He thought that he would be able to kind of nurture and provide for me, even though he didn't have any experience, right? He didn't know what it was going to be like. He knew this was going to be very challenging and tough. And he just felt that at his present time in his life, it was under my best interest that he would kind of spend most of the time. And I think he was right. Definitely was not easy. I can tell you that. I mean, my dad spent most of the waking hours at work. And then on the weekends, he tried to spend as much time as he possibly could with me. And that was typically driving to some like nature-esque place to either have some kind of like lifelong teaching or, you know, some kind of storytelling in some capacity. But my dad, I think, knew very early the way and the direction in which he wanted to raise me. And that was pretty deliberate in his approach. And that kind of, I always say, you know, his background being born in Japan and then coming to this country, then mixing the kind of Americana culture mixed with, you know, his like conditioning of being Japanese was this really unique component at times where it was this like consistency of trying to always reach for something that is bigger and better, but also kind of this relentless pursuit of excellence to try to reach perfection, knowing that it's seemingly unattainable, but doing whatever it can, doing whatever he could to provide that atmosphere. And it was also interesting because I'm not sure the reason why, but I think my dad always felt that I was at some sort of a disadvantage as opposed to maybe other kids that I was competing with or that I was in school with. And so he communicated that to me, and he always would tell me, like, you have to do more. You're going to have to do things a little bit longer. It's going to take a little bit more effort, focus, and drive associated. And that's fine. That's okay. But the one thing that I think was different with my father is that there was like kind of this always this like limitless expectation that he had. And he also thought that I had limitless potential. So when you kind of mirror those two and you communicate those things to a child at a really young age, over time, at least I like to believe that, like, I think I started to believe them in some capacity. And that was reflected, I think, in my athletic prowess.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why I ask that question is a lot of times with people with success, I've had other Olympic champions on and NFL players and NBA players and actors and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, we all are shaped by our parents. We're shaped by our community. We're shaped by that village. And with one parent, kind of one hand tied behind his back, you also had that opportunity, I'm sure, where there wasn't always that parental guidance around because you said your dad was grinding. And so you could have taken a right-hand turn and not turned out to be the type of guy, you know, that you turned out to be, right? And so it's just interesting the way that we are driven and the guidance that your dad had and the foresight of really trying to challenge you on trying to become the best version of yourself as a little kid. And not many parents do that in that way. So that's pretty cool. Now, I am a former, well, I'm a fellow Seattleite and a former. I don't live there anymore. But I know that when I was growing up, like, you know, football and basketball and baseball and soccer and things were the main sports. I know that you started off in the pool and that was kind of your energy. But like I never even heard of speed skating, you know, especially growing up in Seattle. Like, I was affected, you know, I've been doing the mountaineering game for the last 10 years. But I was also influenced by the guys that came before, way before me, the Whitaker brothers and Ed Veesters and guys like that, who were climbing Mount Rainier en route to Mount Everest, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think about the mentors and the guys, like there's the Huskies for me and the Seahawks and all this stuff that I was looking out at these guys, like these guys are rock stars, Steve Largent, all these guys. I want to be like one of those guys. And like, how would you ever get inspired by speed skating in terms of the early days from Seattle when that wasn't really a sport up there, I don't think.
It wasn't a sport and there was no real kind of localized place to train and compete. I just thought it was the coolest sport I've ever seen in my life. So like many kids, I grew up playing traditional American stick and ball sports. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a football player. I wanted to be a boxer. My dad said no to both. I saw this crazy sport of short track speed skating on television, immediately kind of fell in love with it. And the idea of like racing around this like ice hockey rink going at like unforeseen speeds to pass other skaters seemed really cool. But it wasn't until my dad took me to Vancouver, BC, in which I watched a few of the local short track speed skaters compete. So the Canadians were skating in these localized competitions. And when you're a kid, when you're like 12 years old and you see a sport like short track and these athletes that are leaning over at these angles, it actually doesn't, I mean, even today it doesn't look real, but you know, my brain can obviously assimilate the information to understand why it's actually happening. When I was that young, it looked like they were flying. And so as a kid, like the only thing as a kid I ever wanted to do was like learn how to fly, right? Like basically fly through the air. So it was like a superhero dream and like fantastical in nature. And that was when I really fell in love with the sport. When I saw these guys doing these like crazy passes and their legs were just like so muscular and so big. And they just looked, I don't know, they didn't look real to me. And that's how I really just, I basically wanted to replicate whatever they were doing in those corners that made them hook around at these crazy angles. It just looked so fun and so cool. I mean, I can still, just talking you through, I can still remember this in my head about what the first images of that looked like. And then me kind of peering against the glass as a young kid, like looking in and thinking like, wow, like I want to do that. And then trying to replay that in my head when I was on my own on these like weird off ice hours at like midnight in like the middle of Tacoma, Washington, at like a beat up old hockey rink that like no one wanted this ice time on a Friday night. Right. And I'm skating there with like a couple of my friends trying to replicate what we saw in Vancouver. And we've like taped together these mattresses all on the outside wall to protect us if we ever fell. Right. Obviously we didn't have all the mattresses, but anyway, that that was the entrance into the space.
So if I remember right, you know, again, this is me as a younger kid watching TV. I can't even remember. I can't even frame this up. I remember your skating. I've seen you skate several times, but you know, I go back to like Dan Jensen, right? And so I'm thinking about, I think he was out of Wisconsin, and what I remember from him in particular was just how he had these massive trunk legs, right? That really, obviously you need to have the power to crank out. What is the prototypical, like when you diagram it up, like what, and I'm saying, I'm asking this question because I don't know. If you want to ask me about what a football player looks like, I can go by position and tell you exactly. You know, I look like a quarterback or a wide receiver. I'm that height and that frame. I'm not a lineman. I'm not an NBA center. But what kind of frame are we talking about? Which is, maybe it's you, maybe it's not you, but like if it's the perfect prototype, what does that look like?
So for short track, it's different than long track. Long track, they're much taller. But for short track, I would say the perfect prototype is somewhere in the 5'9 to 5'11 range. Strength to weight ratio, obscene, off the charts, meaning I would want that sub 150 in terms of body weight. But I want them to be extremely powerful. So, you know, if you were going to use like, I don't know, a back squat analogy, like a leg press analogy, like at least leg pressing 1500 pounds to 1700 pounds, somewhere in that range. Extremely small, like no muscularity from the waist up. And I'm talking about looking more like Tour de France rider physique. And then from the waist down, from the belly button down, just being incredibly powerful, but very sport specific. And so there's a couple of like technical aspects as well. Like you want the hips to be actually rotated forward a bit versus like football, everything is like chest up. And because you want to be able to manage that load of basically hitting another human, right? Like over and over again. In speed skating, you don't want to be like this. You actually want your hips to be tucked under.
Right.
Which is like, you know, if you're in a back squat and you're, you know, your back is fully supported by the body weight, that's how your spine is basically protecting against injury. In speed skating, you want the complete opposite, where your back is rounded over, your hips are tucked under. And it's this weird, obscure body position that is very unnatural to most people, especially if you come from like a weightlifting background, which many of us did, right? And that was the biggest hurdle and challenge in American short track speed skating, was that we trained on the sports science component of utilizing strength to weight ratio in the weight room, but that did not always translate to the power being generated in the ice because it was such a technical sport. So someone like who, you know, this was pre-Russian being very strong in the sports in short track, but like in 98 till 2010, the Russian team was physiologically probably one of the most fit and powerful out of all the countries in the world. But they couldn't put it together technically. So they'd waste 50% of that efficiency that would go right out the window when they jump on the ice. So it'd be like, if you're someone, you know, as a lineman, one guy is in mud and the other guy is in dry with like fresh cleats.
Yeah.
And like the power is so much different, even though they're both the same strength, right? One is just kind of slipping away and the other is just like plowing through. That's the same similar analogy to what happens on the ice with some of these athletes. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I get it. Okay, so help me understand this. So you're a kid, you grew up just south of Seattle, Washington, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And so now you've got this fascination, you're starting to visualize it, you're starting to see yourself flying. Now you go up to Vancouver, BC, you see some guys that are out there, and now you go back down to your track in Tacoma, and you set up some mattresses or something around some old rank, and you're pretending you're one of those guys. Like, but at some point in time, like with me, like Little League, you know, I started off in 89, so those are 8 and 9 year olds. And before that, it was like 7. I was out there throwing the football and all that kind of stuff. And so there was a path and there was a playground and all the kids were doing the same thing. Like, how did you put yourself in a position growing up in Seattle where there's no track, right? And then you got to go find a coach and there's no coach. I mean, how did that, I'm trying to be like, how did that all, the trajectory, like in terms of your path, because I know you started doing well early, but like, I mean, you have to practice, you have to do all those things, you have to learn the game, right? And where did that happen?
So that happened mostly by learning and mimicking and replicating what I saw when my father would drive me from Seattle across the border to Vancouver. So whenever we were there, we would spend the weekend there from Friday until Monday morning very early. We would drive back, or Sunday night very late after the competition was over, after practices were over. And that's where I would learn as much as possible. And the other elements, I mean, Mark, was just simply like my dad was obsessive, right? Like, he was someone who believed that the more repetition that I could put in, the more likely that would become muscle memory. And the more muscle memory would become more ingrained into the technical feasibility into my body and my mind. And so a lot of this was spent like just honestly just experimenting on the ice in Tacoma, Washington, in these like localized hockey rinks, and just practicing what we saw. And then I would continuously go and sign up for all of these races in North America, where I would go and race against real athletes who were training with real teams and clubs. Well, we didn't have that. We didn't have that in Seattle. And also there was like, I had like a real chip on my shoulder, right? Like, I would show up to these competitions, Mark. I didn't have the right equipment. I didn't have a proper racing suit. So like, instead, you know, a racing suit's like a one piece racing suit that's very aerodynamic. It's fit to the athlete to eliminate drag. You know, to speed skaters, it looks pretty natural and cool. Well, I didn't have that. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So my dad, what did we do? Well, we went to Big Five and we bought like a black, you know, like long sleeve, like small, extra small that I would wear. And then I would just wear like a bottoms that would go underneath, like if you were going to go skiing, like, you know, like underpants. Yeah. And these kids, obviously, you know, kids are rough, and they would always say stuff like, oh, who's this clown? And I didn't have enough. I didn't have a lot of money. Right. So my father would make me wear my swimming jacket in the, like the heat box. So you can imagine, right? This like weird looking kid who's like not from this area. I'm the only American in these competitions. I'm not wearing the same thing. I mean, I'm an outsider in every essence, and I'm foreign, right? And I'm wearing this like bright red and blue swim jacket, like those like parkas that you see that they wear in the warm-up area. And they probably have never even seen this thing before. And on the back, it says Highline Swim Club. Right. So like, you know, these kids are like, they're brutal. They're hammering me. And so that created this like inner psychology of like, I wouldn't say rage, but like some significant anger.
Yeah. You're going to go like, kick. So
all
you're
I wanted
go
to do,
kick some ass.
I wanted to kick their ass. That's all that I wanted to do. Yeah. And so that summoned something that created this alignment and focus. And for some reason I was able to harness that in a way that, you know, I started going to these localized competitions, and I'll always remember this one race because it was the first race that I was competing against someone who had a national team skin suit, a racing suit, which means that they had performed, that they'd been on the national team. And I was wearing my little stupid getup that was like from Big Five, or I don't even know, maybe Value Village. It was like basically donated. I don't know if you guys, people who don't know about this,
I know Value Village.
Okay, so, and so I'm wearing this outfit and I hear this other, I'm not gonna say his name because he's a friend of mine now, but I hear this guy talking to another person in the heat box before we're about to go do a time trial. It's not time trials where one man or one woman's on both sides of the ice rink and it's 9 laps and they basically chase each other to see who's the fastest time. And then that seeds you to categorize you in terms of the rest of the races. Anyway, so this guy was basically talking trash about my outfit, which, you know, he's got every right to, like, what the hell was I wearing, right? And I just remember thinking in my head that all I could focus on and concentrate was like, all I wanted to do was to stay with him. Every lap was to match him, every lap for the first five laps. No matter how fast or slow he went, I was going to stay with him and stay with him. And then when it was four laps to go, I was just going to like lay the hammer down and go as hard as I could. And something like ignited in my head where I was in this flow state where all that emotion was channeled into this arena where everything in the outside world no longer mattered. It was me and him. It was just us on both sides of the ice rink. And it was really beautiful. I mean, I was like only like 13 years old at the time, maybe 14 years old at the time. And I did exactly that. And I remember just kind of like just keeping him there, like in my like peripheral vision and just kind of matching his speed. And then four laps remaining, I saw that he started to get a little bit fatigued. And that's when I started to go and really, you know, basically kick it up another gear. And we got off the ice and I remember Space, and he was like, not only devastated. And then his brothers just started talking incredible amounts of trash to him, you know, because of what just happened, you know, before. Anyway, but that was like this first, I think, instinctual desire and competitiveness that I think was really there. I had it in swimming. I had like little glimpses of it, but nothing like I saw in speed skating where I actually needed someone else to be there for me to be my best. If I was time trialing on my own, the lap times and the overall time was kind of sub average, right? It wasn't exciting. But if someone else was there to push me, there was some competitive drive and spirit that was within me that made me want to step up to the plate and adapt time and time again. And that's when I knew that I was actually much more suited to be a short track speed skater, meaning I was much more in tune with racing than I was long track speed skating, which is all about the clock. It's like track and field, right? You just go as fast as you can.
Yep. Okay. Good stuff. So let's jump forward and then go back again. Overall, you won 8 Olympic medals, 2 gold, 2 silver, and 4 bronze. You started in 2002, 2006, and 2010. Those are the Olympics that you were in. At what point in time before that? So you have this moment, right? And you're in the zone and mm-hmm. you rip past this guy. And now you have this awareness that you can actually do this. And I know what you're talking about too, being in that zone. I used to do the exact same thing on the football field in terms of out conditioning other people and just watching them drop when I'm still standing straight up. And it's just an amazing feeling to have, like, okay, I got you now. Right. And so at what point did the Olympic committee, whoever those people are, identify you and like, you know what, we're going to pick you? Because if you were on the 2002 Olympics, you must have been like, if I go back 3 or 4 years before that, you must have been in the zone and in that progression with the Olympic committee on starting to be like considered to be one of the guys, one of the members on that Team USA.
So there was a competition in Red Deer, Canada, where it was basically like a Pan American, like, you know, North American competition against Americans and Canadians. And I was chosen as one of the local club skaters from the West Coast to go and compete. I was 13 years old at the time, never competed and went with a team on an actual trip. And I performed very well. I won all of my races. And it was at that point where there was some other scouts or junior development program coaches, and actually one of the national team coaches who was also there. And they looked at each other. I didn't know this, but they told me this later. They looked at each other and said, we have to get that kid into the training program next year. This was 1995 and 1996. So they had seen, I think, potential that I didn't see in myself at a pretty early age, as coaches do, right? They see behavioral traits and patterns in something that they think could be really special. And they approached my father and said, Mr. Ono, we'd love for your son to come be a part of the junior development program in upstate New York and Lake Placid, the host of the 1980 Olympic Games. Yeah. And your son is supposed to be 15 years old. That's the cutoff, but we're going to try to see if we can pull some strings to get him in early because we think your son could make the 1998 Olympic team, which is only a year and a half or 2 years away. Yeah. And so my father had brought me in and told me about this incredible opportunity to go and to be a part of this incredible training program. And now again, like, I'm 14 years old, Mark. I don't know what any of this stuff means. I can't even fathom what it means to live on the other side of the world to me, the other side of the country, yeah. You know, away from Seattle and especially away from my dad and away from all my friends. And I didn't want to do that. So instead of saying yes to my dad, I said, I don't really want to go. I know what I want to do. I want to stay here in Seattle. It's the summertime. Why do I want to go on the other side of the country? I have no interest there. Why can't I just skate here? What's the difference? I just didn't get it. And my dad, seeing like lightning in a bottle here and seeing how unique this opportunity was like, I'm not going to let this kid throw this opportunity away. And so he forcefully said, you're going to go. I don't care if you want to go or not. You are going to take advantage of this opportunity and you don't know what is good for you right now. I'm your father. And you know, that whole spiel. And he takes me to SeaTac Airport. My dad drops me off. I wave goodbye and he drives off and I walk in and I walk right back out. I go to the payphone. I call my friend and I say, hey, I'm supposed to go to New York today, but I'm not going to go. Can you come pick me up? And then for the next like 9 days, I spent bouncing around from house to house, all while my father believes that I'm still in New York, but I'm so pissed I don't call him from the program. Obviously, there's like some red flags there that he's like, what's going on? Why is my son not calling me? I haven't heard from him in days. The coach who invited me calls my father and says, Mr. Ono, you know, curious if you still had planned to send your son out here. Obviously, we saw that your son never got on the plane. He's like, what are you talking about? Long story short, my father figures out whose house I was at. We have a very in-depth conversation. Again, he's like hammering me around this incredible opportunity that was being lost that I just couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it. It was right in front of my own eyes, but my dad saw it. Mm-hmm. So again, like pure love out of my father to take the bull by the horns and say, you're not going to throw this away. So packs my bags, gets on the plane with me, arrives in Albany, New York, makes the 2.5-hour drive to Lake Placid, drops me off, shakes their hand, says good luck, and gets back on the plane to go back to Seattle. And it was in that environment, Mark, that I really saw the power of mentorship and the power of coaching. And that really stuck with me today because, you know, I was a rambunctious kid with tons of talent and a unique feel, like a feel for the ice that was less about the physiology and more just this innate awareness that I had on the ice. I could almost dance on my skates without, you know, it didn't even look like I had skates on. And the coaches saw that. I didn't necessarily believe or know that I had that, nor did I understand what it would mean to make the Olympic team. And so from me being there, this coach, Patrick Wetland, saw the best way to coach me was to push me and to show me what was possible. And then also psychologically, there was a whole bunch of things that were kind of coming into that realm. And so what was really cool was that, you know, 8 months later, I competed in the national team trials, which would go to the world championships. And I ended up winning that competition at the age of 14. And so the implications of this were like not seen before, right? 14-year-old kids still have braces, beating guys that were 37 years old that had made two Olympic teams in the past. And no one had seen me 2 years ago. Like I came out of nowhere. And so there was this belief that like, wow, like the next American short track speed skater is going to put speed skating on the map for the United States. Like we hadn't had a strong team in decades. We hadn't had a dominant skater in decades. We'd always been kind of at the back of the pack, so to speak. And so, yeah, a lot of hype around this. And so I went to that, you know, along that path, I came back home instead of training, which this was the 96, 97 season. Now I'm going from 97 to 98 season after having won the trials, being technically the captain of this team, to then coming back home and having this deep conversation with myself around like, what do I do now? This is the off season. Do I just like kick back and relax? That's what sounds like the off season to me. All while all the pros are at home, like getting in the most incredible physiological shape of their lives and preparing for the season to come. This was like the off season was really where you made yourself. This was like where you did the volume of training, the blood, sweat, and tears was really at the highest level. And I was eating like Taco Bell and like hanging out. Like I had no idea. I was like clueless. And then I showed up to the training program with a pretty bad attitude and an attitude of one of which just going through the motions and not doing the work. And that reflected in a kind of a very volatile relationship with the new national team coach. I had moved to Colorado Springs to train with the national team at the age of 15 and a very kind of self-destructive and defiant against authority mentality where even though they wanted something good for me, I almost defied that in a way just because. And I think a lot of it was it was a conflict, personality conflict with the coach that I wasn't willing to bow. And, you know, the coach was like, look, I'm the coach. Like you have to show some signs of respect. And I just didn't want to do that. I was out of control. And then, you know, I showed up the 98 Olympic trials, and I got dead last. And this was the biggest turning point, I think, in my life, but also in my speed skating career, because upon finishing dead last, right? So like 9 months prior, I was number one in the US. Now, all of a sudden, now I'm dead last. The entire arena is talking about what a lost statistic I was. I was supposed to make the Olympic team. You know, my father being Japanese, the Olympic Games were being held in Nagano, Japan. My parents were, my grandparents were supposed to be there. They already bought tickets. My dad had bought tickets. Like, this was like devastating to him, right? He had left Japan to come to the US, and now he's coming back to Japan. You know, it was like this like incredible homecoming story for him and my father, and it didn't fit the mold. And so he took me to this remote cabin in this area called Copalis Beach. I don't know if you've ever been there, Mark, but it's an area near Moclips, which is like near Gray's Harbor. So like,
okay, yeah,
all the way on the coast.
Sure.
And you drive north a little bit. Really rugged, really beautiful. And there was this old cabin. They've since renovated this cabin, but the cabin was called the Iron Springs Resort. Okay. And the Iron Springs Resort at the time, and I have all love for the family that had this resort before, but to be completely frank, like this thing was like, it was beaten down. It was on its last leg. But that's where we would go, right? For like family vacations. My father and I would like drive there because it was so cheap to stay in these cabins back then. And we would stay there for like 3 or 4 days. And my dad would like take me and like, we would go hike. And it was like, it was amazing. And he drops me off at his cabin and says, you're going to stay here until you figure out what it is that you want to do with your life, whether it's speed skating, whether it's academics. I know one thing is for certain. You are not going to throw away your life and go through the motions. You are not going to throw away this gift that you've been given. And so that was pretty eye-opening for me as a 15-year-old being dropped off there. It's raining. It's the middle of December. There's no other humans around. It's just the woman who works at the front desk, and it's me and my clothes, and I have like a journal, and I just kind of start mindlessly training. And so in that 7-day period that I was there, my dad went back home to Seattle, and I started kind of mindlessly training and writing down my thoughts about why I was there. And it was this fork in the road, right? Like, what do I really want to do? I was like throwing away this incredible opportunity. In the back of my head, I always felt like I could have made that Olympic team, but I didn't, because I threw it away, no one else. And even if I did make the team, I threw away the opportunity to be my best. And that was like, that was pretty hurtful. And so that insecurity was embedded pretty deeply into my psyche at that age. And also like this like feeling of disappointment, right? Where this like fear of failure was always very resonant, but also this understanding that like, because I didn't give 100% of myself, there was some like a performance that was still there that was left, that if I did it again, maybe I could make it again, right? So I left the door open a little bit. So I basically call my father after like 7 days of being there, and I tell him I made a decision that I wanted to continue on this path again. And then, you know, like 4 months later, after the Olympic Games had competed, the team had come back from Japan. We had competed in the world team trials, and I finished 6th place, which was the double alternate for the team, which means that I would not be skating in any individual races, but I would be there to participate. And the whole time I went there, Mark, I just wrote down a whole bunch of notes about what I would do when I went home. I wouldn't call my old friends. You know, I would stay focused on the tasks at hand, and I would try to actually be my best at the sport. And that's where the obsessiveness came in that I think I probably inherited from my father around work ethic. And I spent the whole summer just, I literally didn't hang out with any of my friends. I didn't hang out with any kids for 5 months. All I did was train every single day, twice a day, sometimes 3 times a day, and go to school. So I did. I had no life. I was at the age of 15. And then, you know, when I showed up back into the national team training program, I was in phenomenal shape. I was dominant again. And that was the turning point for my career, that was the light switch.
Yeah. Okay. So you threw a lot in there, and there's a little bit to unpack. You know, I don't look at like what you just said, you had no life. I think you had a sensational life. And I used to ask myself, you know, it's so easy to be average. And it's really, really difficult to be great. And what do you want to be, average or great? And for you to do, I had the same kind of, you know, fork in the road. My freshman year of college, things had always gone kind of my way. And then I've told this story many times, so I won't repeat it. But the bottom line is that, you know, it was just like you're going to take door A or door B. And it was a big, big, big moment. And there was no certainty, just like with you, that if I did A, B, and C, that, you know, anything great was ever going to happen, that I'd play in the NFL, that I'd play at the University of Washington for you, going on to the Olympics and making the team. But there was such a strong desire, there's such a strong purpose and why, that that's what drove me And so on the nights when people were going out and, you know, going to parties and doing that, and I wasn't doing that stuff and just staying so disciplined really over the course of my life in terms of when I get up and what I do in the morning and just get my, and activate my brain and all those types of things. You had the exact same thing too. I mean, those were just all laying the ground for all these great things that were to come. And you did ultimately go on to greatness, right? I mean, how many guys can say that they've, I don't even know a speed skater. You're the first one I know. And then to actually just not participate, not just make it, but just, you know, take a sport that's not even a saddle-based sport. I had the convenience of having all these resources, you know, right down the street. And you didn't, you know, you had to like create that. And then you had to travel all these distances to go there. And then you have these opportunities. And then the question for you is what, you know, are you going to step through the door and go for it or not? And then finally take on that mentorship of these different coaches that really help lead and become the best, help you become the best version of yourself. You know, as we step into the Olympics now, and we could go, this could be a, like a 5-hour podcast with you, Apollo. So I appreciate your time. And I'm, I know you've probably talked about this, you know, the most, or, you know, of all these different races you've been in, when you won the silver and you fell down, I think it was your last Olympics they were in. And then, you know, all you guys slide in the wall and the guy that's in the last place ends up winning the gold medal. And then it's just a fight for you to turn around and then swing your leg across the finish line and beat the other guys that are trying to do the same thing. I think that that moment to me, as you're kind of recapping this whole story, this whole thing about, you know, the grit, about staying in that cabin for 7 days, about writing down the journal, about having to go through all that hell, and for you to have that final, you know, that awakening that you want to be this amazing athlete and person in your life, you're going to have this drive. That's what that moment, when you hit that wall and when you went down, it's not the gold medal to me. It's when you spun your legs across and you won that silver when you went down. And, you know, how disappointing, because you're probably going to win the gold. But, you know, that grit that you showed in that particular moment, to me, goes back to all those times that you went through that heartache.
I agree. Look, the silver medal in the 1,000 meters at my first Olympic Games and my first Olympic final in Salt Lake City was probably the most meaningful and impactful and the most important medal that I ever won. Even though the color was not the original intended color, which was gold, it was actually silver. Yeah. And I think it was also a pretty meaningful time in our country. You know, I've spoken about this in the past around, you know, it's kind of similarities around the chaos and the uncertainty that exists even in today's world around the geopolitical nature, the polarization in our communities and economy and political beliefs and identity in general. And I think that the one thing that was unique about that time, Mark, was that, you know, when September 11th, 2001 occurred, that devastation, 6.5 something months later were the Olympic Games in Salt Lake City. That's a very short window in which everything was still front of mind for people. And we were very much asking, do we even host these games? Why are these games important? What if there's another attack on a grander scale? If there's sleeper cells that exist inside this country? It was a real threat. And I was like 18, going on 19 years old, I think, at the time or something like that. So, you know, I remember getting up in the morning 6 months before and like knocking on all my teammates' doors and seeing everyone huddled on the TV and seeing what was happening in New York, because, you know, we would get up at 5:36 in the morning and we were seeing what was going on. And it was just a crazy time. And then to be able to walk into the opening ceremonies and have the flag that was flown at the World Trade Centers being brought in and being carried by brothers and sisters of mine who are representing Team USA was a really like viscerally powerful moment of unification and solidarity. And to zoom out, right, on kind of not only like sport, when you're in it, it's the bubble. Like everything revolves around every fleeting second of time that you are interacting with the sport, and it's beautiful. But in that moment, it was almost as if sport was so small, but it was also so representative, regardless of result and outcome. And so we as Americans were on our feet. We had always kind of with bravado always said, like, we're number one, we're the best, we will always be the best. and at the snap of a finger, kind of brought to a knee, so to speak. And that was like the stark reality that we're still so fragile and life's so fragile. And then my first Olympic final, I was like mere feet away from the finish line of winning gold. And a snap of finger again, I had fallen and a whole pack of us knocked down. I had stabbed my own leg. We could have either stayed down or we could get back up, and not knowing what the end result's going to be, but to continue to fight on and continue to push that struggle forward. So I felt that, you know, I don't know if I could have articulated it at the age back then, 20 years ago, almost coming up on the anniversary here. But that was something I think that, at least I'd like to believe, that Americans believed in and people around the world, to say like, hey, life will always give you a route and a path that sometimes you're not ready for. And just when you believe you are getting ready for the most incredible slam dunk or home run or touchdown of your life or gold medal, it'll smack you down into the pads or onto that cold, hard ice surface. And we often think, I believe, in those moments that this was taken from us and it was not our fault. And we have to point the finger. And that's okay. And that's natural. And I think that's the human response to do those things. But there's another side that says, hey, maybe this lesson in life wasn't actually about you winning the gold. Maybe this lesson was all about how you reacted and responded when you got knocked down, and the fortitude to be able to get yourself back up and throw and finish the race. Just finish. You got fourth place, you got fifth place, you got disqualified, whatever that was, you finished the race. And I think that was like a teaching, that was a life lesson that I'm just so deeply grateful for. And almost that stoicism of belief to, you prepare a lifetime to be your best, but in some capacity, you can't always control the outcome in every essence. And you have to surrender to that outcome in its result. You don't have to be happy with the result, but you have to surrender to it and accept it for what it is. And then you go on and you try to reinvent and you pivot to do things differently or to go and attack it in a different way the next time around. And that's what that taught me, is that kind of grit that exists inside, I think, all human beings. Sometimes some of us don't even know the light switch is there, and we're not placed in those situations until we're facing like severe financial loss, or we lose a loved one, or whatever the harsh of realities that life gives us. That's when we have to sometimes stand the most tall and be the strongest. And it's really hard. It's really hard, especially with all the types of information out there that exist. And, you know, I've said this many times in the past, look, the mind is the world's most powerful tool and asset that we have, or it can be the world's smallest and most powerful prison. Mm-hmm. And how we live in between our own 2 years is up to us. That's why I decided to write that book, is to be openly transparent around the toxicity that existed between my own 2 years, how I was brought up, the amazing love that I received from my father, the implications of how that developed in other areas of my life and how I carry that forward. And then how I continue to push that ball forward, as you spoke about at the beginning of the pod, right? About trying to lift up others, trying to help other people see the light, to know that there's a reservoir potential that exists within them that perhaps they don't believe in yet, just like I did when I was 14, but other people saw it in me. So it takes all of us to continuously push this forward. I love it when people win. I love it when people come back from devastating circumstances. And to me, like, the Americana culture is like when someone is down and out and they come back from like unforeseen like obstacles and odds, and they somehow survive. Like, I don't know, that like that to me is like still so. That's what motivates me on a daily basis. So
the name of this podcast is Finding Your Summit, and what you just described really is peaks and valleys, right? Mm-hmm. And I am older than you, and the one thing I've learned in my old age here is as I look back, there's no question that the adversities that I've had, and there's been a lot, have all served me well into the future. But like you said, it's your mindset. It's what you want to do with that information, right? Do you want to take that negative thing that you know came at you and use that to sink you, Or do you want to take that and say, you know what, it sucked, but I'm going to use that and I'm going to go forward. You just can't stop moving, man. That's the one thing I've learned over time is keep pushing, keep pushing, keep pushing. There's going to be setbacks. That's life. But if you keep going, ultimately you'll come out on top. That's just, you know, I've learned that and there's been so many life lessons. You also use the word pivot. You've had a number of different pivots since, you know, so let's talk about really life after football. You've written a couple of books. You're on Dancing with Stars. You actually won. That's incredible. But today you're out. I know you're doing a lot of public speaking and tell me if this is the most current book or maybe it was the first one you did, Zero Regrets. But the whole idea about helping others become the best version of themselves and hear from a guy and all these struggles that you were just talking about of where, you know, your dad was forcing you to do something that maybe you really didn't want to do, but you later in life, you turn that around and use that as fuel. And that helped you, you know, go to three, which is incredible, three Olympic games, win a whole bunch of medals and do all these great things. Is that where you're finding your joy? Because a lot of times for a lot of people, I'm one of them. Like when I went off that NFL cliff at 30, I was just like, okay, what next? Right. I didn't have the tools ready to go. And it took me a couple of years before I got things rolling, but it was a hard transition until I got my focus and my drive and my purpose, you know, under my feet again. And then, you know, I took off. But for you, have you had that same thing, or was it like a natural handoff when you decided to, you know, put the hang up the skates?
It may have looked like a natural handoff, but in chapter one of my book is called The Great Divorce. And it, you know, it starts with a quote from Viktor Frankl: when we are no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. So it talks about this like reinvention / transition process from identity one, which was Apollo Ohno, Olympic athlete, Olympic champion, into like, who actually am I beyond sport? If I no longer have skates with me, what am I interested in? What am I good at? What skill sets have I developed? What business acumen do I have? What opportunities exist? Am I at an advantage? Am I at a disadvantage? I'm still just as competitive, but I don't have the foundational frameworks that other people have. So I felt immediately both discouraged and lost. And the one thing that was very unique, I think, that I did that I'm very lucky for was I said yes to everything, Mark, because I knew that I didn't have enough experiences. And so it took me all over the world, both in terms of having incredible success and also massive failure. But along that process, I was able to re-identify with other facets of my curiosity and personality that drove me to be fully immersed in new environments, which forced me to get out of my comfort zone. Because the world that I came from was pretty operationally consistent, right? I knew every day the way that I operated, almost robotic-like. When I went into the business world, it was all new. Dynamics in Asia, doing business in Asia, was so foreign to me in every essence. Doing metals and mining's business, doing textiles business, doing real estate, doing manufacturing, all this stuff was like, huh, what is happening? But I think you have to be constantly thrown out of the nest, so to speak, right? And the nest for me was actually the Olympic space. And even people say, oh, you trained so hard. I knew the blueprint. Even though I reinvented the blueprint within the sport, now I was entering into this arena where I had to face my inner fears, my desires, and the imposter syndrome, where many times I was like, shit, man, I don't know if I belong in this room. These guys are so smart. They have so much experience. What the hell am I doing here? And after the guy says, hey, would you mind signing something for my daughter? And I say, sure, sure. He says, tell me about the business. And then I'm like, all right, here it is. Here is the opportunity. This is the layup. You either deliver or forever you are reverted back to, well, I had a meeting with Apollo Ohno today. Not the brightest of guys, but really nice guy. That would be the conversation. And I hated that. I wanted nothing more but to say, I wanted them to say, had a meeting with Apollo Ohno. Wow, I was impressed with how much he knew about the business. And actually, he's with a great group. And, you know, we might do some business together. That's all that I actually wanted. Recognition. That was interesting, right? So the ego was still very much a part of my personality at that age because I still had, like, to me, it was unfinished business. I still wanted to win and show the world that I could be something outside of sport. It was so important for me to do so. And so I shied away from that in every essence. But what you talked about, the transition was really hard. And so also during the pandemic, right, a lot of people were furloughed from their jobs. A lot of people decided they no longer wanted to do that path and career anymore. And they decided to do something entirely different. And what we know about human beings is the conditioning process of doing something for a long period of time is hard to break that habit. That's why January 1st New Year's resolutions typically 80%+ of the time don't work, because you revert back, right, to what was normal, what was easy, until something devastating is happening or years ago, like some kind of crisis that forces you into action where you're like, okay, no, enough is enough. And you increase that like level of standard for yourself that didn't exist before. So yeah, this book is like all about transition, all about going from point A to point B, all about reinvention, all about like if you are lost and feeling uncertain and feeling overwhelmed with chaos, how do you embrace change in a way that I can't promise you outcomes. What I can promise you is that you show up fully on a daily basis, willing to have your face towards the flame and towards the fire with courage. And that's what I want in people. Because within that storyline that we know that we were all told as kids, is this incredible confidence and character building that allows you to withstand anything that comes your way. I used to believe, Mark, that the people who completed these Ironmans or mountaineering or whatever, I was like, these guys are insane. Like whoever does that is crazy. And I didn't realize it. So I did an Ironman in 2014. And what I found was in the final 6 miles of the run, after doing the full-on Ironman in Kona, the last 6 miles was when it clicked for me, was when I was like, this is why people do this like endurance race, is because it puts them against themselves throughout the whole day. And you're told by your mind that you can't do it. You can't do it. You can't do it. And then you continue to inch and progress along that race. And then there's 6 more miles. And then there's this belief that says, I'm here, I'm going to survive, and I'm going to finish it. Even though like my cells internally are aging like 40 years in this time period of 10 hours beyond this track, something goes beyond the physiology of what is really possible. So I don't know, like those things to me are like really inspirational, motivational. And you know, that's why the book is just, it's important to me. So the Dancing with the Stars stuff, super cool. Way outside my wheelhouse, very uncomfortable to do that show. Yeah. But again, like a life lesson in terms of what's possible and what's feasible. You got to put the work in. The work is the shortcut.
Yeah, no, I love it. I mean, our stories are so similar. So, you know, my Ironman was coming Mount Everest and, you know, almost not coming up that mountain. Cool. Yeah, I mean, it took me 18 hours to get up and get back down. I was the last guy up the mountain and people had left me. Wow. And, you know, so running out of oxygen, I'm blind. You know, I have all these other things going on. And it's just like, is this going to, like, what's your true why? Because you are so on the edge of, you know, when you're talking about the Ironman, you know, for the most part, you're not going to die. You might quit.
Right.
But you have that realization of, you know, now's the time. It's you against the world. And that's what it is. And so what do you want to do? What do you want to make your life of? Like, the outcome is going to occur out of all this adversity that you're going through? It's not easy to swim 2.5 miles and bike 130 or whatever you go, and then, you know, jog a 26 mile course long right through the lava fields. I mean, it's intense, and you have to do a lot of gut checks, especially if you're not a professional and doing all this kind of stuff and all these other things that you were talking about. The reinvention, the going out there, the digging deep, stepping into the fear, doing it with daily discipline, never ever quitting, and always commit. I mean, these things, like you're saying, otherwise it is a New Year's resolution and most people quit, you know, those things when they go along. So where can people find you? You've got just great content. I mean, I'm so appreciative of you coming on the show. You've got so much insight on all these different things from when you were a little kid through the Olympic years and now what you're doing today. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Apollo Ono. You can find me on Instagram at Apollo Ono, my website, apolloono.com, where you could order the book. And yeah, and then, I mean, my,
and the name of the book, again, I want to make sure that you get a proper plug with that.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark. The name of the book is called Hard Pivot.
Hard Pivot. There you go.
Yeah. So the name of the book is called Hard Pivot. You know, I wrote it for the past 2 years, embrace change, find purpose, and show up fully. And, you know, I think everyone, look, the one silver lining of whatever this pandemic was that life is fleeting and the time never stops for anyone. And how we choose to live those 86,400 seconds per day is up to us. And we know that we can't win all of them. But every day we have a new chance and a gift to try to win as many as we can. So whatever career path that you're in tech, you're in finance, you're in your business, it doesn't matter, right? Like, how do we just live our best lives? Because I think we are destined to grow and progress. And so we have to keep burning hot.
You know, this is really weird for me to say, because I don't feel it in any kind of way, but I just turned 60, right? I flew down to Ecuador, climbed Cotopaxi, drove down, did 60 push-ups. But, you know, I really believe this, that, you know, the game is just beginning for me, right? I mean, I've been able to do some cool stuff, but this is where you really start to accelerate, right? This is not the time to be going out to a golf course and retiring and laying down all your guns, man. Now is the time just to, you know, go out and attack. No. I really believe that.
Everyone's different, right? But for me, retiring is like, I can only imagine it's like one foot in the grave. I have to be crawling towards something. Like there's something fun about that. And whether it's like a health and fitness goal, whether it's about like learning a new language, whether it's about the writing, it's gotta be something that's like keeps your fire burning hot. That's the essence of being human. Obviously like being present and enjoying the moment, like these things are all important, but I don't know, man, I love the grind. That's why I still work so hard. And I try to wake up daily with some gratitude, you know, it's really important.
Love it, love it, love it. All right, man. Totally appreciate you coming on. We'll post all the different links in different spots once the episode comes out. And again, total pleasure having you on, and you're on the right path, man. So there he is, the one, the only Apollo Ono. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season. And inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at guardianbikes.com. That's guardianbikes.com.